Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll discuss Seminole history and culture at the Ottauquechee Museum on the Big Cypress Reservation.
We helped build Fort Lauderdale. We helped build Miami. We helped build everywhere there was a camp. There is now a major city. So we helped build those industries of tourism because people wanted to come and see the Seminoles. They wanted to come to see the unconquered.
We'll discuss women in British colonial Florida.
Most were born in Great Britain, possessed some level of basic literacy, and maintained regular correspondence with distant family members.
And we'll talk about the Florida Minority Baseball Alliance. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Seminole flute player Gordon Ollie Wareham is also director of the Ottauquechee Museum on the Big Cypress Reservation in South Florida. He is the nephew of the museum's co-founder and first director, Billy Cypress.
Back in 1989, this idea of this museum was born from my uncle, late uncle Billy Cypress, and the then former chairman, James E. Billy. They had an idea of creating a spot, a place that we could tell our story. There's many museums and historical societies around the state of Florida and around this world that tell the story of the Seminoles, but we needed to tell our story, so this is one of the reasons why they created this place.
In the past, historians have written that the Seminole first arrived in Florida in the 1700s. More recently, the prevailing view is that there is a continuity between the Seminole and other tribes that were in Florida before that time, such as the Colusa, Tequesta, and Ais.
Our stories talk about the tribes coming from Louisiana, Mississippi, and Georgia, coming into North Florida and establishing bases there, but meeting those tribes that were there before. And then, of course, during the wars, the Seminole Wars, they were brought south. And the idea was being taught in schools to even today that all the indigenous tribes either died off or ran away into Cuba or into islands. Our stories was, no, they were still here. Those families coming from the north merged with those families that were still here. And the reason why we know that is because of our stories and our medicine. Their languages within our language, their stories are still being taught. This is how we know that we are the indigenous people of Florida.
Historians have labeled the conflicts of the 1800s as the First, Second, and Third Seminole Wars. The Seminole view those wars as one continuous conflict.
It was one continuous war, and really it wasn't a war. To us, it's genocide, and it's a continuing story of a genocide of people being removed, people being killed off because they're different. One group thinks that they have no right to be here, and the other group saying, hey, we're humans. This is our historical homes, and there was no other place for them to go. So if you want to call it a war, but to us, it was survival. And that's why we consider it not one, two, or three wars. It's one struggle that we even fight for today.
People escaping slavery in northern colonies came to Florida and joined the Seminole. After the Seminole Wars ended, hundreds of Seminole were never captured and never signed a peace treaty, making them unconquered.
To us, it means our struggle, our way of life lives on. And we have understanding it wasn't just us fighting. We had freemen fighting along beside us. That's the Black Seminoles. We understood there was other people throughout the years that helped us become the Seminole Tribe of Florida, friends of the Seminoles. But it took our ladies, because we are a matriarchal society. We get our clans through our mothers. It is that power. It is that resilience that keeps us here. And so when we say we're the unconquered, we're actually saying it's our women, our ladies, that give us that right to say that, because we get our abilities from them. We get our families from them. We get our identities from them. So that is what we mean by the unconquered.
Driving around the Big Cypress Reservation, where the Atatiki Museum is located, large herds of cattle can be seen grazing in expansive fields. Wareham says that cattle have always played a significant role in Seminole history.
From cattle keeper, from the first kind of the historical of Seminoles owning cattle to even today, I think we are the second or third biggest cattle owners in Florida. Cattle runs through our blood. I come from a family of cattle. My grandpa Willie Frank, he had a herd of cattle here on the Big Cypress Reservation. So to the Seminoles, but the Seminole people, this is how we are first introduced to business and having that relationship with that market. So cattle was really, really important to our survival.
The Seminole grows citrus, and one of their most profitable agricultural enterprises is sugarcane grown on the Brighton Reservation. These and other agricultural endeavors have had an impact on Seminole culture.
Agriculture is seasonal. And because of that, there's things that have affected us year-round. And one of the things that we do celebrate is a green corn dance. There's a story of how we are introduced to corn, and we honor that process. And to make sure that, you know, we see this as the beginning of our year. Tribal members, they come together, like I said, in families and in groups and clans, and they celebrate the new year. And this is, it is an agricultural kind of a celebration. And this is how, you know, one of the things that we do on a yearly basis.
In the early to mid-20th century, the Seminole were active participants in Florida's early tourism industry. That's when the colorful, elaborately patterned clothing associated with the Seminole came into being. Gordon Wareham.
That tourism affected the way we clothe ourselves. And because of that, the more elaborate he was, that meant more people came to that shop. And so if the store owner could keep that Seminole longer, that meant more business for him. So he wanted to have that good relationship with that Seminole, because he wanted that Seminole to come back, because if that Seminole came back, more people would come to the store, a better deal would happen for the Seminole, because the merchant would have more business. So that relationship between us, the tribal members, and the, I guess, the business owners, and that trade would be really, really great. And so throughout the years, Seminoles started having their camps near cities and doing the alligator wrestlings and doing the little camps. And that brought more people into those areas. We helped build Fort Lauderdale. We helped build Miami. We helped build everywhere there was a camp. There is now a major city. So we helped build those industries of tourism because people wanted to come and see the Seminoles. They wanted to come to see the unconquered.
There are many photos of tourists posing with elaborately dressed Seminole. The Seminole also became known for their dolls, baskets, and wood carving.
The tourism business boomed, especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even today. People still come from all over this world to come to Florida, come to this museum, because they want to see the Seminoles. They want to see the unconquered. So they want to take something back, and it's usually a little doll or a jacket or some necklaces, you know, made by tribal members. And so, like I said, it's amazing that people know about us and know about our stories, and we are so grateful for them to learn and then to take that home and tell other people about our culture and our way of life.
Atatiki means a place to learn or a place to remember. Atatiki Museum Director Gordon Wareham.
We have culture departments, we have elders, we have people who tell stories. And what we try to do here is to inspire our tribal members to bring that spark, to learn a little bit about themselves, and then point them in the right directions to go. If you want to know your language, go to the culture department. If you want to learn a little bit about your history, this is a person you need to talk to. Preserving our culture, we have an oral history, an archive that we can have tribal members come and listen and learn from. But then we say, this is the elder that you need to speak to if you want to learn more. And I think that's the best thing that we can do for our tribal members, is to actually inspire that tribal member to actually want to learn more.
A boardwalk is part of the Atatiki Museum experience. Visitors encounter a Seminole hunting and fishing camp and a Seminole village, but are mostly surrounded by nature.
Our boardwalk is 1.1 mile, and it goes into a cypress dome. Now, it's really hard to do that today because a lot of the federal laws are protection laws, so it's hard to go into a dome like this. This was made back in the 80s and 90s. And so you'll go into and you'll see a pristine area, a very clean area. And you'll see sometimes wildlife in there. It's bears, panthers, foxes, raccoons. And then, but you'll also be at peace. If you go in there with an open mind, you'll actually have nature talk to you. And you just go in there and you can lose yourself for 2 or 3 hours. We've had people, you know, actually stay in those areas for about 4 hours, reading each and every sign and just in a journey, and they come out like a brand new person. So it is an incredible place in there.
Gordon Ali Wareham is director of the Ataki Museum on the Big Cypress Reservation in South Florida. He's also a Seminole flute player. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and follow us on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, one of the least studied periods of Florida history is the British colonial era that lasted from 1763 to 1783. Deborah Bauer focused on a topic that is even less studied, the role of women in that era.
Deborah Bauer, at the time a Ph.D. student at the University of South Florida, published an article in the 2010 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly on the role of British women in the colonization of East and West Florida. The pertinent historiography is limited and centers on two opposing interpretations, a romanticized or glamorized perspective that British women living in Florida were charming ladies, well-traveled, gowned in silk and jewels, who spent their time attending balls and social assemblies. Their contribution to the establishment of the social order was limited. A second historiographic interpretation contends that, as was typical for almost any frontier community, women were scarce in British Florida and implies that no further study is necessary. Bauer challenges both views. Studying the experiences of British women who immigrated to East and West Florida during the period 1760 to the 1770s will provide a foundation for understanding the social-cultural development of British-controlled region. The British capture of Havana in 1762 ensured that the Spanish allies of the French would make substantial concessions in the subsequent negotiations that resulted in the Treaty of Paris that ended the French and Indian War. Acquiring Spanish Florida, the British set out to integrate East and West Florida with the southern colonies that ranged from Virginia to Georgia. As the historian Kathleen Wilson argued, British women offered civility, refinement, and sensibility on behalf of the common good, as governmental and military officials sought to make East and West Florida the latest success story for the expansion of British imperial power and prestige.
What sort of challenges did women face in Florida?
Bauer offers a general description of the women who immigrated to the colonies. Most were born in Great Britain, possessed some level of basic literacy, and maintained regular correspondence with distant family members. They read the Bible and literary works and had basic knowledge of arithmetic. Many had training in the feminine arts of music, dancing, sewing, cooking, and housekeeping. Most were members of the Church of England and came from economically prosperous families. A number of them shared kinship with prominent families in Boston, Charleston, New York, and Philadelphia. The number of men and women who arrived in St. Augustine in the 1760s did not number more than a few hundred in the years of British control. Numbers alone did not define the role of British women. Their arrival in 1763 established an immigration pattern that would continue for the next 20 years. The women who immigrated to Florida were the wives, daughters, mothers, or sisters of government officials or members of the military. They entered a new physical and social environment. When Dorothy Forbes arrived in St. Augustine as a newlywed, she confessed to her family that although she was in a strange place, they should not worry about her. Fortunately for her, other women assisted in her acclimation to the surroundings and to her status in the colony. As wives of government officials and military officers, women like Forbes could claim elite status and associated with the most powerful members of the colonial society. Women faced many of the same dangers as men. Traveling by land entailed possible violent encounters with indigenous people, and most women traveled by ship. Storms represented ocean hazards, but so did mutiny and pirates. Rebecca Walker Dunford, the wife of the Lieutenant Governor of West Florida, was aboard a ship bound for England when the crew began drinking during a storm and mutinied. Some of the crew entered her cabin, and she was thrown out of the berth with the bedclothes twisted around her and onto a black trunk. She was rescued by a ship bound for Nova Scotia, but as Bauer notes, not all colonial women were as lucky in the same situation. Shipwrecks were reported with some regularity. Tropical storms and hurricanes battered the Florida coasts then as now. Elizabeth Digby Pilot reported on a 1769 storm that left her terrified by, quote, the violent tempest attended by heavy rain. As she described the scene, the whole camp was in an uproar. The soldiers' huts were mostly blown down. The women and children were running about screaming with consternation. Then men were all in confusion, and a scene of sad devastation presented itself. Disease and other medical issues affected the health and shortened the lives of women who immigrated to Florida. The heat and humidity were especially difficult for women who were expected to dress modestly. Beset by swarms of insects, they were susceptible to malaria, yellow fever, cholera, dysentery, and smallpox. Of the six women who accompanied Elizabeth Pilot from Havana to Pensacola in July 1765, all six died during an outbreak of malignant fever, possibly yellow fever, which ravaged Pensacola between late 1765 and early 1766. Pilot reported that coffins were so scarce that a single coffin was used repeatedly to transport bodies for burial. Death was so familiar, she wrote, that we met our friends with sad countenances, expecting to hear some new victim. While men and women faced the same likelihood of death by disease, women faced the demands of childbirth frequently and without access to the level of medical care they might receive in England or in more settled colonies. The pregnancy history of Dorothy Forbes provides insight into the complexity of marriage, family, and childbirth. In 1772, Forbes was pregnant with her third child. Weakened by three closely timed pregnancies, she was concerned for her own health. Her mother had died in childbirth, and wrote to her father about her worries. He arranged for her to travel to Milton, Massachusetts, where medical care would be better. By the time he arrived to escort his daughter and grandchildren north, Dorothy was 7 months pregnant. Her husband refused to allow the children to travel, but finally compromised and kept the oldest son with him. She arrived safely and gave birth to a third son, but she never saw her husband again.
Connie, were the lives of British colonial women in Florida always so grim?
Women occupied their time in Florida in some productive and entertaining ways. In 1770, the West Florida Assembly enacted legislation that provided married women limited freedom regarding property. Rebecca Dunford took advantage of the opportunity and acquired several large tracts of land in her name. However, in extending the privilege of landholding, the Assembly was recognizing the danger of life in Florida and the potential need for women to be able to provide for themselves. British settlers established an active social life. In the evenings, singing, dancing, card playing, and gossiping occurred in the various homes of the colonists. Governor James Grant was known for his frequent dinner parties and evenings of entertainment.
By the mid-1770s, the end was in sight for British Florida. How did the colony change as the American Revolution progressed?
The most obvious change could be seen in the migration patterns. As a non-participant in the Revolution, Florida served as a safe haven for loyalists escaping from the war. Elizabeth Lichtenstein Johnston, the wife of a loyalist Georgia physician, arrived in the fall of 1782 with a flood of other refugees. The population of East Florida swelled from approximately 3,000 to over 20,000 during the final years of the Revolution. The final British ship left St. Augustine in June 1785, completing an 18-month evacuation, with most colonists sailing to Nova Scotia, the Bahamas, or Great Britain. Among the many evacuees were British women whose lives and contributions to the colony had been largely overlooked. As Deborah Bauer argued, it is time to write them into the narrative.
Indeed. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. As Holly Baker reports, the Minority Baseball Alliance is commemorating the history of the Negro Leagues in Florida.
I recently talked with Coach Bobby Gilbert, who served the Greater Palm Beach County School District for nearly 20 years as an educator and head baseball coach.
My name is Bobby Gilbert. I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida, born and raised right here. I grew up playing baseball my entire life. I'm 41, so I've been playing baseball involved with the sport of baseball for almost 30 years plus now. So this is what I do. I have three sons. My oldest boy, Bobby, just won a state championship with William T. Dwyer High School in basketball. And my two youngest boys, Blaze and Brody, they are baseball fanatics like their dad. So yes, ma'am, that is me in a nutshell.
Coach Bobby Gilbert's passion for baseball inspired him to establish the Florida Minority Baseball Alliance.
The Florida Minority Baseball Alliance is a group of first-class coaches and community partners that have come together to synergize our efforts to connect, educate, and promote the game of baseball throughout the state of Florida to minority families and also to the underprivileged, to give them the resources that they need to help stay involved with the sport of baseball.
One of the goals of the Florida Minority Baseball Alliance is to highlight the history of baseball in the state. In the late 19th century, professional baseball excluded African Americans from league play. As Coach Bobby Gilbert points out, when Henry Flagler added a baseball diamond between two of his most fabulous hotels in the 1890s, many talented black players honed their skills on his baseball field.
He was looking forward to making sure that he provided entertainment for his rich Palm Beach visitors. And so he built the golf course, and then he also built the baseball field right between the two resorts, the Breakers Hotel and the Royal Ponciana. One of his requirements to work at either one of the resorts was that you had to play baseball, right? And so this is around the same time when the Negro League season was coming to a close and they wanted to continue to work and find work and play baseball. And so it kind of worked hand in hand, Henry Flagler needing players, and then those baseball players wanting to find work, they would come over and be bellsmen, chauffeurs, cooks, whatever the case may be. And on their off days, they would play baseball in front of some of the most important people, pioneers in America, you know, the Vanderbilts, the J.P. Morgans, you know what I mean, of the world. The Negro League guys were the entertainment for them.
One of the men who played for Henry Flagler was Andrew Rube Foster, whose Chicago American Giants played for the Royal Ponciana team against players from the East representing the Breakers. In 1920, Foster founded the Negro National League, a professional league for African-American ballplayers. Known as the father of black baseball, Rube Foster would go on to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
In our research, we found Andrew Rube Foster, which is the inventor of the Negro League Baseball, was actually playing baseball here for Henry Flagler at the Royal Ponciana Hotel in West Palm Beach. That kind of sparked the curiosity of like, wait a minute, let's keep going with this and try to figure out what we can find that's in here. We knew that Josh Gibson, known as the Black Babe Ruth, he came through here, he played ball here. Hank Aaron, obviously. Satchel Paige, Jackie Robinson, for sure. You had so many different people that came through here playing baseball before they actually had the Negro Leagues invented. And then after the Negro Leagues was invented, they still came down almost like a spring training for most of the African-American baseball players.
By the early 20th century, professional black baseball teams were springing up all over Florida.
One of the first leagues that was developed was called the Southern League of Colored Baseballists. That was right here in Jacksonville, Florida. That history does something for me. Once you can connect it to it, it's just, it means more. And so we want our kids to understand, our players and our parents to understand that baseball is being played from the top part of Florida all the way down to the bottom part. You had teams like the Fort Lauderdale Giants, Deerfield Cardinals. You had the Pensacola Arthur Giants. You had the Pensacola Seagulls. You had the Miami Giants. You had Tallahassee Capitals. You had the Tallahassee Pirates. Like, the list goes on and on and on of all these great baseball teams that play here and all these African-Americans and minorities that actually played the game of baseball right here in the state of Florida. And so it's very important for us to make sure that we're able to put that information out so that people can feel and draw a little bit more connection to the sport. Because if they can draw more connection to it, that will actually promote kids to want to say, you know what, I can do that, because that's exactly what happened with Buck O'Neill. Buck O'Neill is from Florida and he's in Hall of Famer. And he actually came down to West Palm Beach because his uncle was he worked on a railroad, and Buck O'Neill would come down with his uncle to West Palm Beach and they would come and see Rube Foster play for Royal Ponciano Hotel. He said at the time, he said, one of the greatest things I could ever have seen in my entire life was seeing that many black and minority people playing baseball and seeing those guys do it at that level. I knew it was something that I could do. And he went on to be a Hall of Fame coach. It's about that connection again, right? Being able to attach yourself to it, see something, and then say, you know what? I can do that because he did it. So we want that to happen here in the state of Florida.
The Florida Minority Baseball Alliance celebrates Florida's baseball past, present, and future, while emphasizing the history of minority baseball in the state. On May 20th, 2023, the Florida Minority Baseball Alliance will host the first Florida Shine Classic in West Palm Beach at the ballpark of the Palm Beaches. There, they'll provide 50 minority baseball players with an opportunity to showcase their skills in front of college coaches, scouts, family, and friends.
Florida has become, over the years, a football state. It's been known as a football state, but I would say now, with all the history facts that we're finding right now, Florida is a baseball state, and it will always be a baseball state. We just have to bring up the history of it and just kind of put it out there and let people continue to see it and produce it in a cool way, because most of our minorities don't want to hear a lot about the struggle part of where we come from and things like that. So we want to highlight all of the positive, cool things and try to do it in a way to where it's tasteful for them and their generation. And so that way they can kind of feel more of a connection. One of our hashtags that we use with Florida Minority Baseball Alliance is called We Belong Here. So that's what our organization is all about, is supporting our minorities, supporting our underprivileged youth and these parents, be able to help them find the resources that they need to continue along in this path of playing baseball.
To learn more about the Florida Minority Baseball Alliance, go to ggination.com/aboutfmba. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.